What is going on, everybody? Welcome to A Theology of Hustle. I'm your host, Curry Blanford, and today I am talking to Luann. So it's really cool. I actually saw Luann's book in my local coffee shop, and come to find out, we're kind of neighbors and we frequent the same coffee shop, which was super cool. And so we sat down to talk about her book called Hurting Yet Whole, Reconciling Body and Spirit in Chronic Pain and Illness. And I just thought, this is such an important thing that we need to talk about when we're talking about work. Chronic pain and illness is something we don't talk enough about when it comes to work. And so we talk about some of that stuff, what that looks like, what even chronic illness in work looks like. And it just brings us into so many different incredible conversations, like who we are as people. Like, do we have usefulness as people if we can't work? What is the main essence of what it means to be human? And I think for many of us, that has become very utilitarian, and that we're only useful if we can do things. And so this, I think, episode will challenge you in a lot of ways, even talking about ability and disability and some of that stuff. There's a lot of really amazing stuff, a lot of wisdom here. I think you're going to get a ton out of this episode. Before we get started, I just want to remind you to make sure you're following me on Instagram and Facebook at Theology of Hustle, and on Twitter at Curry Blanford, just to stay up to date with the podcast and all sorts of amazing people I have coming on. And yeah, I hope you enjoy hearing from Luann. All right. Well, Luann, thanks so much for coming on the show and talking with me. It's such a pleasure to get to meet you.
Yes. Yes. After we met at the local coffee shop.
It was so bizarre. I knew we had just scheduled this interview and I saw you walk in. And I was like, that might be her. I don't know. But yeah, just cool that we live like so close and frequent the same coffee shop. It's pretty fun.
Totally. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's get started and just have you sort of introduce yourself to everybody a little bit.
Sure. Yeah, I'm Luann. I live in the West Chicago city, which is in the west suburbs of Chicago, with my three kids and my husband. And I've been doing freelance writing for about, I guess, running on 12 years. Before that, I studied anthropology at Wheaton College and University of Chicago. And write about topics of spirituality and embodiment and kind of the intersection of faith and culture, probably like a lot of the people you've had on your podcast. So yeah.
I love it. That's good stuff. Before we get into kind of the book and sort of walking through your history, I'd love to just like explore sort of you coming over to the United States. I know there's like, yeah, there's just a lot there. Anytime, I guess, I talked to somebody who grew up in a different culture, right? Like was raised in a different culture. I like to explore how vocation was sort of shaped for them in their, in their family structure. Does that make sense?
Yeah. 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 I was born in China and moved to the United States when I was three. And, I grew up in Southern California for the early years of, or Texas, South Texas, and then Southern California. And then when my parents divorced, my mom moved to a town in Southeast Texas and started a Chinese restaurant there with my stepdad. And we were the only Chinese family in town. There was one more Asian family who were Filipino. And so, yeah, we ran our little Chinese restaurant, and I got a lot of interesting jokes about being Chinese. And yeah, just tried to figure out how to fit in and be who I was in that unique setting.
Yeah. Yeah. And I can only imagine the jokes. I'm from, you know, Texas, not the same area, but yes, very much understand some of that culture there. Mm-hmm. How do you feel like just being from an immigrant family and sort of like starting a restaurant even, and like the work that your mom and stepdad did to sort of keep things, you know, going for y'all? How do you feel like that shaped you like in how you think about, you know, your work now?
Mm-hmm. So they were very busy all the time, and they were also not present a lot of the time. For example, I was on the dance team in junior high and high school, and I think my mom maybe attended like one dance performance. So for me, seeing like they had to be at the restaurant all the time and comparing that to like my friends' parents, I felt like I wished my parents were something different than they were. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until later that I started to kind of understand the way that, well, I should also add that my parents were undocumented. So my mom and stepdad were undocumented. And so they couldn't hold a lot of the regular jobs that right. people can hold. And owning a business was one way for them to have a steady income and be entrepreneurial. And at the same time, it meant that they were kind of pouring all of their energies into this business to keep it going. Mm-hmm. And for them, that was loving us. That was their way of loving us, was to yeah. provide for our futures. But I felt a lot of, I'm not bitter now about it because I've processed through it, but at the time yeah. I felt resentful about how much they worked. And mm-hmm. I always told myself, like, I will not work so much when I grow up, and I won't make that such a overwhelming, kind of like all consuming part of my life. But at the same time, I recognized out now that had a lot to do with their socioeconomic status and their immigration status, why they had to do that.
Yeah. There's a certain privilege that comes with having sort of free time, right? I mean, yeah, that's a privilege.
Yeah,
that not everybody has, right?
Right. So. Even the question, like, what do you want to do when you grow up? Like, that's yeah. a privilege to be able to ask. There's lots of people that just do what they need to do in right. order to make a living. So, yeah, that I had the option to explore different vocational paths and. I didn't end up going down a path that my parents would have wanted, which is the stereotypical, like, make, you know, go to an Ivy League school and get a well-paying job, because we sacrificed a lot to make this happen for you. So I felt at the beginning, a lot of kind of guilt or shame about not kind of living up to what my parents were hoping for me, or not kind of making their dream, their American dream, work in that yeah. way. Yeah. But that's gotten better. I think their main concern for me was, you know, being able to take care of myself and make a living. And as a freelance writer, that's not something that's like guaranteed for sure. Right, but and then that's another privilege, is that my ability to explore freelance writing has come out of the fact that I'm married to someone who has a full-time job, and I have that privilege as well. So right. a lot of different things.
Yeah. There's a lot of factors into all that stuff. Yeah. Yeah, totally. And I think mm-hmm. you realize some of that stuff when you have, like, you have three kids, I have three kids, you realize like so much of why your parents did what they did in hindsight, you know, mm-hmm. it's like, oh yeah, yes. this, like, paying a mortgage sucks, you know, and like, mm-hmm. yeah, like life yeah. is hard.
You know? Said, yeah, right. Yeah. All the things that I said I would never do, I'm doing now. I'm like, oh yeah, it's part of parenting. And you also do what you know too. So it's hard to break out of the parenting styles that you knew right. from growing up.
Yeah. Yeah. You're exactly right about that. Very much so. Good. Okay, so let's dig into the book, because I think a lot more of sort of your vocation and thoughts on that will kind of come out of how we sort of explore the book. So can you just talk about mm-hmm. Your book, Hurting Yet Whole?
Sure. It came out of when I graduated from Wheaton College in, was it 2009? A year later, I started having ankle pain, which I thought was going to be something that went away after a couple of weeks, but ended up dragging on, and did the thing that everybody does when they have something chronic, which is go to see countless doctors and try different things. And for me, because I had never had any instance in the past where my body hadn't worked for me, it also created an existential crisis of sorts where I wasn't sure, like, who I was anymore. And who God was for me anymore, because I'd never had that experience of kind of not being able to do what I wanted to do and being unproductive and feeling incompetent and weak and vulnerable. And so as I started to process through all those experiences, and my pain actually did get better after a few years. And we can talk about that too later if you're interested. But as I was thinking through all that, like that kind of darkness and despair and existential stuff, I realized that some of that might have had to do with how I was understanding what healing was, and that it was at the beginning more about being fixed and going back to a state of perfection, which I now understand that we maybe have never been perfect, and that letting go of that is part of the healing process and learning to embrace what our bodies are. So that's where the book came out of. And yeah, like you said, it does also tie into questions of vocation, because a lot of how we think about vocation has to do with what we value and what we think of as productive or good, and what a good life is.
Yeah. Yeah. It is amazing how much stuff you cover in this book, to be honest with you, like exploring the creation narrative in an incredible way. I think a really helpful sort of like lens shifting way, but also just, yeah, talking about privilege and talking about, you know, abled, which I'm excited to get into that with you as well, to talking about women and how women disproportionately struggle with autoimmune disorders. And, you know, like there a lot went into this book. You could definitely tell.
Thanks. Yeah. I tend to be, interdisciplinary in how I think. So sometimes that becomes overambitious because I try to fit too much into one project.
Sure.
But yeah, that's who I am.
That's cool. Oh, also, we both graduated from Wheaton in 2009, because that would have been when I did my, I graduated from grad school in 2009. So
we were there around the same time.
Yeah.
Might have seen
you
walking.
And at the same graduation.
Right. Yeah. That's bizarre. And that we probably crossed paths multiple times. I always think about like the people that I drive by in the car that I might know. And I'm like, or that I'm like one day going to meet.
Yeah. Right. Isn't that funny?
Yeah.
Such a small world, and yet such a huge world at the same time. Yeah.
Yeah.
So. Okay. So how do we dive into this? Let's just talk about our ideas behind a chronic pain, because there's and we were talking about privilege already, but there's a certain prosperity gospel way we think about our health in general, I would say, in our in our North American church, which is that health is the sort of like end goal, like or it should be the ultimate, like that's normal, I guess, you know. Health is, and anything unhealth is bad, and you know, part of this, the fall and some of that stuff, and you explore that in the book. And I know that's a big question, but do you mind sort of like unpacking a little bit of that?
Yeah. You might want to start with Proverbs and those wisdom books, where there's a sense, and I think that it's a true sense that we get from reading those books, that good actions result in good consequences. And we want to believe and act upon the idea that God created a order and a set of laws that we can kind of rely on in the universe. For if you plant the seed and you water the seed, then it will grow and you'll get your results. And if you're a good person and you don't lie and cheat and steal, then you'll be prosperous and all those things, I think. And we teach our kids that because we want to live in a world where that is the case. And then we don't live in a world where that is the case often. You know, the big question of why do bad things happen to good people is so hard to answer. Yeah. And so then when that doesn't happen, then it's very instinctual to say it's because you did something that's off. And so when I first started having pain, I had a lot of that, like, what did I do? What could I have done differently? Was it because I was like, I did a lot of fasting my senior year in college. I think it wasn't like the most healthy kind either. It was like partly spiritual and partly because I just wanted to be skinny, honestly, talking about women and women's bodies as a young woman. So anyways, I was like asking lots of questions about my own actions and how they led to where I was in this state of not being able to walk around more than a couple blocks. That went on for several years. And once I started asking those questions, then I had to ask that question to like the suffering that I saw around me, whether that was like the couple in church that had a stillborn child or the people that were fleeing from war in Afghanistan, or all these different ways that I saw suffering and what seemed like just meaningless suffering and pain being experienced in the world. So once you've experienced enough things in your life, then you realize that narrative doesn't work, that like you do good things and then good things happen to you. But at the same time, I think there's a biblical precedent for wanting to believe that too. So
yeah,
it's challenging to then go back and say, well, if it doesn't work that way, then how do we make sense, or what do we do when we encounter this kind of suffering that seems so unnecessary and so painful and like it's going to just crush you often, whatever it is, whether that's losing a child or a loved one or physical pain. And it gets really tricky to be in those places where there's just no explanation, and we want so badly to put an explanation on things, and we have all kinds of theodicies around it. And I think like part of my book was trying to do a little bit of that by going back to the creation and fall story too. But I think in the end, like I think my book, if I were to sum up the main premise in one word, it would just be presence. That more important than finding reasons or explanations to our suffering, the more important thing is being where you are and knowing that God is there with you, and that God's presence with you is enough to go through what you're going through.
Yeah. It's hard not to think of, like, I have several friends going through their own, you know, suffering, and when you're in community, you just, like, those things happen, right? Like you're going to come up around people in tough situations. And so, you know, as I was reading your book, you know, we have friends with like sort of like long-term, like really chronic, painful things. And it is so easy as Christians to just like platitude our way out of those things, you know, like, or even try to find a purpose in suffering, as if like, it's needed in order to come about with some like greater good, you know?
Yeah.
So I just found it like really helpful. And even just the way I frame the way I even think about suffering. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's the other thing is I tried not to go to that other end of saying like, well, it's good. Like God ordained it because, he wanted, you needed to go through this in order to be the person that he wanted you to be. There's that other side of it that kind of makes suffering into something that is has like a positive value. And I think that God uses suffering, and it's not wasted, if you want to put it that way. But at the same time, when we're in it, I think we like try to make use of it a lot, like before it's like usable. I think sometimes before it can get to like a usable point, you just have to experience it without needing to understand why or what's going to happen next out of it.
Yeah. Well, and I think like any great doctrine that I've come across as I've gotten older, maybe a little wiser, is that we're called not to have easy answers, but to like sit in attention, which is just like, really hard. Like, mm-hmm. that's about the last thing we want to do, right? Yeah. Is it be in any sort of unreconcilable tension. So it's so much easier to like say, you know, one way or the other that and answer those questions, you know, certainty. So.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah. And it's like there's truth on both sides. So then we want to gravitate toward one side or the other. But I think the Christian life, the true Christian life, is all about paradox and living in the paradox. Yeah. Like, there's a whole book that one of my friends, Michelle Pollack, writes about, the Surprised by Paradox, or I think something like that, where the talking about living in the tension is like, that's our whole life, like living in the already and the not yet, and the Jesus is divine and human and we are beautiful and we are also like really horrendous in the way that we act sometimes. Yeah. Like we have light and dark in us, and we can see that too in, you know, in our national conversations, is there's this tendency to say like, you guys are the bad guys and we're the good guys, and which side are you on? And like healing has to come out of recognizing that that line of what's good and bad cuts right through like the center of our own hearts and through our communities and our families, as we can all see there's so much division that's happening.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. And that's, it's necessary, and it just is, it's hard. It's hard. I mean,
hard.
So part of the issue with even talking about suffering, especially like physical suffering, is that we as Christians are pretty disembodied, I think, in general. Like, our value of the body is not, is something that we struggle with. You know, we have this idea that like, you know, someday when I die, I'm going to sort of float up to heaven and sort of, you know, and I love how you talk about just sort of the incarnation and, you know, can we unpack a little bit about like just how we deal with our bodies and think about our bodies?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The, you know, the first chapter of my book goes into the body spirit divide that you mentioned, how disembodied we are, which comes from a lot of places, including Greek philosophy, like Platonic thought, and how there's the world of perfect forms. And then there's the physical world, which is like the corrupted world of forms. And then, you know, the Greek philosophers thought of women as like less perfect versions of men. And because they were so bodily and kind of so tied to their bodily functions, or their, at least the ways that they were bodies were more visible and more like intrusive and disruptive than the way that men live in their bodies. So, and then there's like the scientific revolution, you know, in the, like, you know, several centuries ago, where we started to, I kind of understand that we could know so much and we could control so much about the material world that we humans start to feel like we were like above nature, that we were like separate from the rest of the physical world, and like, you know, putting ourselves in the place of God often, which also results in a kind of disembodiment, because we try to transcend everything about our bodies that is negative, or we think of as negative, our human limits and the ways that we tend to get sick and we die. And there's like a whole branch of biomedicine now that is about kind of anti-aging, and some of that's good. It's like it has to do with like wanting to relieve the suffering at the end of life, but then some of that is more about you know, somebody told me, like one of the scientists on a piece I was working on about the science of aging said, like, I want to live in a 20-year-old body but have the experiences of 130-year-olds. So that's the kind of like ambition that drives a lot of scientific exploration, or some of scientific exploration, that also results in like an inability to be in the bodies that we are, but kind of wanting to master and control our bodies.
Yeah, it's tricky. Even some of the genetic therapies coming out, where you can sort of like alleviating sort of all human sickness whatsoever, you know, and some of that gets just very philosophically dangerous.
Yes. You know. Uh-huh. Right. Yeah. What I love the question. I've been reading, there's a historian called Yuval Noah Harari, and then some of his stuff, you definitely have to like push against, like, wow, that really challenges like Christian, like central Christian theology. But at the same time, it's really good to like engage with it. And he has a line about when does healing cross into upgrading? And the line is becoming really fuzzy. And then the people that are able to get that kind of healing are the people that have the money to quote unquote healing. So then he talks about, is there going to be like a more like a higher class of humans that afforded all the upgrades they were able to get? And that's the future we're looking at. Those are the kinds of questions we need to be asking, like what's given, like what is, like what should we accept about our bodies, and what should we what is it like valid to push up against and say like, no, this is like, we want to like alleviate this and fix this because this is not good to live with, or it's like hard to live with.
Yeah. Again, that like that narrative of even suffering, you know, goes back to, it's just not, we're trying to alleviate as all of that. And not that like, I think suffering is, we have to have it, but I think there is this idea like, why me? But there's no explanation for these things. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. We want explanations where it's just not possible.
Yeah. Yeah. In my book, I talk about how we've lost the ability to suffer well, because how much of our focus has been on escaping the suffering. And then when you come upon something that you can't escape, then it becomes like you have no tools and resources to be in it and be present to it. And so we find ways to numb it instead. And we go to all kinds of things, and we, our society provides us with all kinds of ways, like consumption and the distraction of digital media that allows us to not face our pain.
Yeah, there's a lot of numbing, easily accessible numbing for us these days. And I mean, that's even becoming more apparent as we delve more into this pandemic. And good. Okay. So can we talk about women and suffering? Cause I thought that was really interesting and something I obviously don't contend with. So I'd love your perspective on some of that.
Yeah. One of the things that struck me when I was interviewing people for the book is that all but one of them were women. And then when I started talking to, you know, hearing all these narratives of chronic illness, the women were often understanding their medical experiences, how they felt that they weren't being heard, or they were being dismissed. Their pain was being dismissed as in their heads. And they often talked about it like, it's because I'm a woman. And so they understood their experiences through partly the gender framework as what was shaping why they were being treated the way they were. So that's when I started to explore that. And there's a lot of literature already out there on the inequality in the medical system and how women are treated. Also, within the medical profession, most of the people that work in the higher levels are still men. So it's still a very much a field where the ways of thinking and the ways of talking are controlled by men. That they get to kind of frame with the way the conversation is taking place. So, So as far as women and suffering, like I started to ask like, well, how much of our suffering comes from like the way that society is set up, so that doesn't have our best interests in mind. And then is there something like biological, like that's just kind of built in to why we have certain, why we have more autoimmune conditions than men do, or like we have, like I think the proportion is like 75% of autoimmune conditions are experienced by women. Wow. And I think it's like you said, it's like an both and kind of a thing. It's like one of those tensions again where you like want to say one thing or the other, like, oh, it's all patriarchy, like down with patriarchy and we'll like we get rid of that, it'll all be good. But then on the other hand, I think there are like these biological realities that we have to live with. And that's where I wanted to explore, like, what does it mean to live well in a woman's body? And at the same time as we're kind of dismantling some of the narratives that kind of make it so that women are dismissed and ignored and kind of seen as inferior in how we experience the world and our bodies. As at the same time as we dismantle those narratives, also being able to embrace our bodies as good, like God created us as women, and God gave us wombs and breasts, and those things have often been ways that we've been oppressed because we get put into like inferior positions, and we can go into like all the whole conversation about gender roles within the work and church, and that causes suffering on a lot of levels. There's so much stress that comes from not being able to like be fully who you are in society and feel like you're always kind of trying to fit into this box that you don't fit into. And I think that goes for men and women. I think there's ways that, you know, men's gender roles and expectations for men can also be stressful and cause health issues because we feel like we have to be a certain way that we're not. But at the same time, like I said, our bodies are good. So how do we embrace that?
Yeah. Again. Yeah. And I do like how you bring up, it's just another tension that we are in and have to deal with. And, it just strikes me as so odd, like going back to your conversation about the Greeks, because, you know, there's a lot of like, those Greek philosophers, I mean, just talking about just that patriarchy and like, how can you say that a woman's body is inferior when they carry like other human life? You know what I mean? It's just like, it kind of, I just don't understand it. And that gets into the Gnosticism and, you know, some of the, I always think about the, I think it's called the Gospel of James, which is like a non-canonical writing from early on. Yeah. But at the end it says, if a woman wants to, you know, go to heaven, she must be basically transformed into a man. And it's just like how we think about our bodies and talk about these things. Like there's been issues in this, like from the beginning, right? Like this this isn't new.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And maybe you could say that it's from like the fall too. Like that kind of changed how men and women relate to each other and how we understand our roles and the curse and all of that. You could have a whole conversation about that.
Yeah, there's a lot to explore there for sure. Yeah. That's good. Good stuff. So can we, I had to stop my wife, as we were reading even last night and just like, the abled versus disabled conversation, right? Cause, people with disabilities in the church, I mean, that's already like a kind of struggle, and I can't remember how you said it. You said it wonderfully, but it was talking about basically like the assumption of abled is incorrect, you know, that any of us basically could become disabled at any given time. Like that's part of life. Can you just explore some of that conversation? And
there's, like you said, we live in, language is so limited. And once we have like the word abled and disabled, it puts people into one category or the other, as if those are mutually exclusive or even healthy and well, as if, you know, you're healthy and then, or healthy and ill, I should say. And then either you're like perfectly healthy or you're like a sick person. And often the reality is somewhere in between, that we're on a spectrum of abilities and on a spectrum of health. And, we might think that being abled is the default, but, we spend a lot of our lives also sick and unable, or even as children, we're unable in a lot of ways. And then as you age, you you start to fall, you know, kind of go down that spectrum toward the disabled view, and then or the disabled category. And we all kind of cycle in and out of these categories. And so it can be unhelpful when we feel like we can either be one or the other, because then our identity gets so tied up in like the ability, and that is the norm in our society, is that, and I think that a lot of that comes from the way that our society values production and consumption, mm-hmm. and kind of making things that make the economy move forward, and what the economy values is becomes what we value as human beings. So, and where we kind of like identify people as more valuable or less valuable based on what they produce. So, I think it's important to start to find new ways to talk about those things that kind of change our own framework as we think about it. I had a conversation with a friend just a couple days ago. And she has fibromyalgia, and we were talking about how she's been so frustrated with the ways that language has, or the lack of having the ability to describe what she's going through, has made it so hard for her to communicate her experiences to others, because she has so many days where she just can't do anything. Right. The fibromyalgia and the fatigue catch up to her, but it's hard for her to communicate that in ways that people that are abled, quote unquote, really understand, because right. like to them it comes across as she's just being lazy. Like, why can't she get up and do things? Like, come on, just get a grip on yourself. And right. and so and she'd internalized a lot of that, and it led to a lot of shame, and like kind of asking yourself, am I just a wimpy person to like, maybe I just can't, like maybe other people like experience this, but they're not like letting it get them down, and right, they're just overcoming right. it and going about and doing things. So maybe I'm just not strong enough. So there's a like those categories and those ways of thinking, like if you're doing things and you're productive, then you're good and you're useful and a valuable member of society. And if you're not productive or you're not working, you're lazy. And we can see that in like the political realm, where like you have to, like earn like a lot of the social safety network net benefits. Like you have yeah. to be like trying to find a job, or even like health insurance, you have to be trying to find a job. And what does that say when we don't give people basic necessities that they need to live, if they can't prove themselves to be worthwhile right. by our metrics of what worthwhile is? So she started to, she found this theory called spoon theory, that came out. It's not really a theory. It's just like this woman had a conversation with a friend, trying to explain her disability or her like inability to do the level of, things that her friend could do. So she just used the metaphor of spoons. Like, I'm given 8 spoons in a day, and every activity that I do takes this, like I have to put a spoon towards that. Like I brush my teeth, that's a spoon. I eat breakfast, that's a spoon. I take a shower, that's a spoon. I check my email, that's a spoon. I feed the dog, that's a spoon. And by the time like mid mornings here, I've run through my 8 spoons already. And most right. people might have like 400 spoons, and I only have 8. And that's like my reality. And I like that. I like that idea, because again, it's like putting our ability along a spectrum. And also like it gives the sense that it's given. It's not like something that we have control over how many spoons we get. And yeah, it just kind of reframes how we think about being healthy or ill or abled yeah. or disabled.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a really helpful conversation to have. And I do the productivity thing, you know, I mean, we're a post-industrial revolution society, you know, and the only thing that matters is if we're capable of working and like contributing to society. Like, humanity doesn't have a a value, intrinsic value in and of itself. And I say the church is just as guilty of this as anybody mm-hmm. when we have like a theological basis for the value of humanity.
Right. And
so, I mean, even like just look at how we treat our elderly populations yeah. in our country, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. right? Like as long as soon as you're no longer productive, mm-hmm. you know, you're pushed off to the side in mm-hmm. some way. And so, yeah, I think we really need to rethink how we think about people and people's value. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's hard to get out of that mindset. That's the water we swim in, you know?
Right. Yeah.
Pretty much so.
Yeah. And the experience of illness or disability forces you to ask those questions of right. what value do I have outside of what I can do? And for me, I did have to just come to that conclusion that it's because I'm an image bearer of God and God loves me. And I have a phrase that a spiritual father of mine would say, like every breath you take is evidence of God's confidence in you, mm-hmm. that you have a purpose. Even if it's just breathing to be on yeah. earth, maybe that's it, but you're giving glory to God. You're kind of being human. And then that being human is enough. Is enough to live on. You right. don't need all the other add-ons in order to feel like your life's worth living.
Yeah. Yeah. You're exactly right. I think that's, these are important things to be talking about, you know, especially as we talk about vocation and, you know, in our world, like you have a calling and your calling sort of satisfies you. And so the ultimate goal, especially for millennials like us mm-hmm. is to like find the perfect job that like, sort of, you know, like yeah. makes you happy in all of these areas and yeah. provides, but still, you know, is good work. And,
yeah. mm-hmm.
and this the disability conversation is like hugely impactful to that. Cause there's people that just can't work because of that. So how do we measure their life, mm-hmm. you know, if they can't do those things. So even the way we talk about work and calling, I think needs to change, you know, because of some of those conversations. So,
yeah, for sure. I've really benefited from theologians who have explored what people's callings are when they get past the point of productivity. And yeah. one of those is, her name's Joyce Ann Mercer, and she's at, I think it's Yale. So she talks about the calling of the elderly when they are mm-hmm. no longer able to do anything that would be productive by society standards. And she talks about a lot about like how it has to do with being and not doing. Like you're living in this kind of really slow paced time, and you know, it's all about kind of your stories and like reflecting on your story and your life. And also like coming to terms with a body that's failing. And yet another thing that she says that's really interesting is that our bodies are always a part of our vocation. Like our vocation is not something that we do separate from our bodies. Mm, that's always right. something we do in our bodies as bodies. So what does it mean for someone who's living in a body that's failing to have a vocation, to have a calling? And she talks about the idea of calling out, that when we are in a state of dependency and vulnerability and really limited function, that we're calling out in the people around us all the character traits that make up the kingdom, like God's people in the kingdom of God, like presence and service and caring for the least of these, and valuing people as people and honoring people's stories. So all of these things are ways that we kind of plug into a community, and like we find our vocation in relationship as people in a community that are giving and receiving. But often the giving is an invisible kind of giving, or a giving that goes beneath the radar, that goes unrecognized. Mm-hmm. It's less about what we give and more about who we are and what we're, and the ways we're calling other people to come into this different way of being.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really good. And just, I think it's hard for us as a society, as people, to like you don't want to deal with the fact that you're aging, you know, like you we want to push that off as much as possible.
Yeah.
Per our previous conversation. So it's even hard to have those conversations because we don't want to think about that being us, you know, younger people.
Absolutely. Yeah. I was having a conversation with like a woman that was a lot older, farther along in the writing career. And I'm just at the point where I published a book. So I feel like, oh, I'm like productive and having like a great time. I'm living out my vocation finally. And she talked about how at some point she had been writing a column for the New York Times and that was like the highlight of her career, which kind of meant to me like, oh, like her career's like on the downhill already. And she was like, maybe like she's like 20 years older than me. So I'm like, wow, that's not much time. Like the amount of time we have like to pursue our careers. Like I'm in my mid, you know, early 30s. And by the time I'm 65, it's like quote unquote retirement age. So that's 30 years. It's not that much time. And so what am I going to like when I'm like 70 years old, how am I going to like live with myself outside of all these things that I do right now that, that I kind of have been like attaching my identity and value to, and what are those things that are going to sustain me when I'm 70, and realizing I'm still a worthwhile person and my life is good, even though I'm not doing all those things that I thought were like the most meaningful thing to be doing at the moment. What is there outside of that? So that's something I have to keep reminding myself as I'm kind of at the beginning of like a vocational trajectory.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's good stuff. And that's like really hard to think through, you know, because we do put so much value in what we do and how we interact with the world. Cause we value ourselves based on our own production, you know?
And not to say that work isn't worth it, but we have to kind of put it at a kind of just distance ourselves from it and say like my work is not who I am. Like it's and in vocation, like, you know, what we do can change throughout our life. Yeah. And then what's left beyond all of that is like I think it has more to do with how we're living out all these things that we feel called to do. It's more about that posture of heart, and that's what we're going to carry with us into every different job that we have. That's going to be the thing that in the end speaks the most to who we are as people of God. It's not the whatever it is, like the running a nonprofit or pastoring or, you know, working in the corporate world. It's the way we did that thing that will speak to people.
Yeah. Yeah. You're very right. That's good. I would like to get practical, here a little bit. So I'm just thinking, so I'll just say, your book had me thinking a lot about myself, which is always enjoyable. But I have asthma. And when I turned 30, it started getting worse and worse and, you know, ended up in the hospital, that sort of thing. And I frequent sort of asthma episodes or whatever. But I've dealt with that. And I saw this in your story. I've dealt with that through lots of different means, right? Like the diets and all of that stuff, right? I've been functionally grain free for about 5 years now, you know, because that does alleviate some of the symptoms, but there is such shame that goes along with that. Right. Cause like, I do have some control over it, but I don't know exactly what control. So when I do have a like asthma attack or whatever, it's like, gosh, did I screw up or, you know what I mean? Yeah. And like, I feel guilty constantly that I have to have medications that take money away, you know, that, you know, there's just such shame that goes into having a chronic condition. And, and I think it is like you talk about people with fibromyalgia or, you know, your foot, you know, where you couldn't do things, how we interact with things like that in the church is really important to who we are. Right. So, can you like, there's just so much that goes into that. Like holding somebody's shame, like understanding, like being gracious. And like you said, being present and still like doing something as the church. So how do we sort of balance all that as Christians?
Yeah. Like you said, those are really challenging areas. And one of the things that we have the tendency to want to do as people, but especially as people in the church that that see one of our ministries as alleviating suffering is we start to kind of want to jump in and fix things right away. And that can often, it can come from a really like good place of wanting to help people and help people feel better. But that can look like asking questions like, oh, have you tried this doctor, or have you tried the grain-free diet or all these things where, and then it becomes again, like the, what are you doing? That's wrong.
Right.
And I think there's a place for sharing all of the health wisdom and things that have helped that we know are like kind of tried and true, or maybe not tried and true, but maybe like ways that have benefited a lot of other people, and especially like you said, like dietary treatments have become really popular, and natural alternative treatments have become really popular. And that in the church too, like that there's a, I think we could have a whole conversation on like what, and people have on like essential oils and all these like things that are out there that kind of represent this whole other framework of thinking about medicine that people have really latched onto. How do we offer like practical support in that way without it becoming something where it's one more thing that people have to do to, I feel like they've checked off all the boxes. I'm doing everything I'm supposed to do, but I'm still feeling this way. So now I think there's a deep need for listening without judgment, without agenda in the church. I think that's like the very first thing that we can offer as people who love other people who live with chronic conditions. There's a need for like practically for people to feel accompanied within all the different struggles they're going through. Maybe that's like going to doctor appointments with other people, or helping them clean their house when they're not able to. And it becomes really challenging, like you said, when it's chronic, because you're in this place of kind of feeling like you might become this burden, like the one that's always needing the prayers and the meals delivered and the practical help. It's like we have an ability to meet acute issues in the church very well, because like, oh, having a baby, let's bring you like a month's worth of meals. Great. We can do that. And then it's over. Or, going through like back surgery, something, same thing. Like we can handle that as a church, but it's way harder to handle when it's like an ongoing thing where it feels like there's no resolution. So, because we like so much to feel like I did something and it like accomplished something positive and I like served and now things are better. But what if you have to serve? What if you're being asked to serve and the situation doesn't get better? Can you keep serving and keep loving without resorting to the, oh, what are you doing that's keeping you in your chronic condition? It's not something we're good at. And again, if it goes back to like the prosperity gospel kind of a thing that we talked about at the beginning of our conversation, that it kind of shakes our understanding of good actions and good consequences. Yeah. So then we don't have good narratives that can help us to reframe what's going on.
That's good. It is. It's hard. Sorry. I'm just thinking of all the those situations in my life, even, you know, it's just, it's hard. It's, it's complicated. And all the way around.
But as far as you mentioned, like the feeling guilty for medical expenses and all that, like it really helped me to think about the difference between equity and equality. And I mentioned that in the book, like equality is where everybody has like an equal amount of a certain thing, but equity is when everybody has what they need. And what having what you need in order to function well might be vastly different for you than for the next person. Like you might need medicine for asthma and you might need like money for more expensive food, because living grain-free is really expensive. I've tried that and it's oh, you have to eat so many fresh vegetables and meat, and it's right. that's expensive, or
is,
nuts
yeah.
or whatever it is that you right. you have to use to fill yourself. That's not grains. So, yeah, there can be a lot of like a sense of like I'm taking more than my share of right. what the limited resources that are available. And then when you start going into alternative medicines that aren't covered by insurance, and
right. yep.
that's another big piece of it where you feel like, well, I don't have, if other people can't afford this, like who am I that I can right. afford this? It gets really tricky to disentangle your privilege and what you should legitimately feel kind of like, oh, that's more than my share versus like, maybe this is something that everybody has or needs, ought to have access to. And right. I'm grateful that I have access to it, like starting out from a place of gratitude. And I also want other people to have access to it. Like, and I hope that like in me taking care of myself and being whole in that way, like that will enable me to then, now that I'm aware of these issues, work so that other people have access to yeah. it and work for other people's health. Because I talk about like in the book about how health is not just an individual pursuit that we do, like me going to the doctor's office, getting my medicine, but it is a communal pursuit. And, yeah. and those like big picture things like policies and how our communities work, and how we treat the environment, those all factor into our health. And so we can start to think about like basically all we do is part of healthcare, and part of being well and being whole. And that helps again, just to take the vision, the focus off of like, I'm taking more of my share. I'm not doing enough, or I'm doing too much, and all of those like angsty questions too.
For sure. That's good stuff. Okay. So Luann, where are the best places that people can sort of find you and follow you and all that stuff? Do you mind giving us the details?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You can start with my website. So it's LIUANHUSKA.com, and you'll find links to my book and to my social media. I'm on Twitter and Facebook, so you can find me there as well.
Awesome. I love it. Well, are you ready to jump into the final two questions as we sort of wrap up here?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So my first question is, what is the strangest job that you have ever had?
Yeah, that was a fun question. So I wasn't sure because I have had these gigs, like these yeah. like little jobs that I've done in college. One of them was being a model for an art class that we in college. I did get to wear bathing suits since it was we in college. So I wouldn't have done it if it was nude. I had a job where I participated in this study where I got to drink protein shakes, and then 4 hours later I ate pasta because they were studying like whether certain protein shakes kept you more satiated than others. So I just took all of my schoolwork to this building and drank a shake at 8 and then did schoolwork and stayed in the building and ate pasta at 12. For like several weeks.
That's a pretty good gig.
That. Yeah, right. I get paid to eat and do my, my schoolwork. And then like, as far as real, like ongoing jobs, I had a job not that long after I started having chronic pain. Chronic pain did keep me from, I didn't want to have a full-time job. It was like really stressful at the time to think about that. I went to the DuPage County Courthouse, and I there's these like public records computers that I don't know why the public records weren't available online yet at that point. Maybe they are now, but they weren't at the time. And I would write down the list every day of like all the cases that came in, of all the, you know, misdemeanors and crimes or alleged crimes that people committed. I would take down all the names and addresses, and my boss who had runs this company would send all these names and addresses to lawyers so that the lawyers could then offer their services to these, people being accused of crimes. So that was a pretty bizarre job.
That is random. Oh my gosh. Wow. I didn't know that was a thing.
That's crazy. Might not be anymore now that there's hopefully things are online more. It's like a thing, like I feel like was like one of those things that will go away with automation, but at the time it hadn't yet.
Right. That's cool. I love that. Okay. So my final question then is, what is one piece of advice you would give to somebody looking to bring God's kingdom more into their work?
Mm-hmm. So I kind of touched on this earlier when I was talking about vocation and when you can't do things, how do you live out your vocation? And I talked about being as like how we are, like our way of being in the world, that our ministry should flow out of that. So I guess there can be a lot of pressure with whether you're ministering in a church setting or in a more like a traditional work setting to do things in order to do ministry. And even the word is do ministry. But it comes out, I think everything we do has to come out of who we are. And so if we cultivate all those fruits of the spirit and those, you know, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control, and cultivate that posture of, I'm a lover of God and a lover of neighbor, and I'm here to be in connection and relationship with other people. Like, that's my purpose. And if we can keep that posture in everything that we do, whether that's in the workplace or at home or in a church setting, then I think that our ministry will flow out of our being and our person and our character naturally.
Yeah. I think that's important. And it's really good stuff to think through as we go about our work, you know? So yeah, good. Well, it was so nice to talk to you, you know, via computer. Hopefully we'll see each other at Kindred again.
I'm sure we will if you're there every day.
It's so good. All right. Well, enjoy the rest of your day. And thanks again for coming on the show.
Yes. Thanks, Curry.
Well, I hope you enjoyed hearing from Luann and just her story and thinking about chronic pain and illness, especially when it comes to work. This is, again, like such an important topic and something we need to be thinking of, especially as Christians. Like, how do we self-identify what makes us precious to God? And that's not that we can work or perform or do any of these things. And I think that's a great gospel message for us. So I hope you're challenged. I encourage you to check out the book. It's really well done. She covers so much topic in this book, and it's really great. So I encourage you to check that out. Now is a great time to go to the bottom of your iTunes app. You can leave a rating and review there just to help get the word out about the podcast, let people know other people are listening. That always helps a ton. I greatly appreciate that. And until next time, get out there and hustle.